Imperial War Museum's Voices of the First World War.
Podcast 35. Life on the Home Front.
He and I used to roam the streets looking at the shops, and I can remember seeing a queue, and some of us would stay in the queue, not really knowing what there was.
The First World War had a profound effect on the lives of civilians. In Britain, people found themselves being gradually drawn into a conflict that had at first seemed remote. Farm worker Harry Smith summed up the attitudes of many towards the war.
Elderly people and so on, older people, they hadn't really got over the South African War before that started in 1914, and it was a dread with a lot of people, especially people having sons grown up to military age and so on, and wondering where it was going to be and how it was going to end. You see, every war that we'd had was always abroad, but this one was a bit nearer home in France, and it was a mysterious affair, wondering, and government trying to kid people on that it wouldn't be last long and all that, it would soon be over with power we'd got, powerful navy and one thing and another.
Agriculture felt the strain of war. Production declined and prices rose. As a grocer's assistant in Yorkshire, Walter Hare soon noticed there was less food available.
Now, the first thing we were short of was sugar, because I don't think we produced sugar beet in this country in those days, and most of our sugar came from, with cane sugar, of course. Canes came from South America, I think. Tate & Lyle produced cane sugar, but no beet sugar, as far as I know, and beet sugar came from Austria, and we were without beet sugar. That was the first thing we were short of. Lard, later on, because most of it came from America. Then everything began to be short. We had to sort of, with no ration cards or like that, we had to ration it out, you see, divide what we had so that everybody got a fair share of whatever there was.
The early months of the war saw some panic buying and hoarding of food. The situation then worsened when Germany began following a policy of unrestricted submarine warfare, which reduced the volume of supplies reaching Britain. Vera Waite recalled how the food shortages affected her village near Bristol.
I well remember a certain person in the village who hoarded a sack full of flour, which there was going to be a great shortage of flour because we had bread made with potato flour. And this person had a sack of flour which she put into her bath and kept it and boasted about that. Well, the consequence was that flour got little maggots. It was no use to her. But I know that several people, my mother included, serve her right for trying to. If she'd shared it out, it would have been much better. But no, she thought and she boasted about this sack of flour that was no good to her.
It wasn't only Britain that was affected by shortages. Across Europe, war soon influenced the production, movement and supply of foodstuffs. Helena Reed noticed a gradual scarcity of provisions in the German-occupied city of Lille in France.
At the beginning, we had very little shortage because we had plenty of food but afterwards it became very, very serious. All we had was a ration of, I can't remember the bread, I remember it was something very dark and it didn't taste like bread at all. No milk. We did have some milk. We had carnation milk or something like that, which was really on ration. The three adults with me really went short to give it to me, because I remember I used to say, "Don't you have some of it?" "No, no, we don't want it." And of course I was having the best. I was the only child, you see.
At least food could be found in Britain and France. In Germany and Austria, people were starving. Britain's naval blockade of Germany severely restricted the amount of goods that reached German civilians. As Walter Rappold recalled, it got so bad the substitute foodstuffs were introduced.
It got more and more serious, so that people got asleep hungry. It got worse and worse. If I may refer to the rationing in Germany during the First World War and the rationing of Britain in the Second World War, it was all the difference of the world. The coffee was not made of coffee beans, which were unavailable. It was made, I suppose, of some sort of vegetables. I never got to know that. Of course, no taste of coffee whatsoever. It was a hot drink. If we were thirsty, it quenched our thirst, but it has no taste whatsoever. Not disagreeable, but not agreeable either.
In Britain, the increasing shortages resulted in goods being unevenly distributed. When a shop had new stock in, everyone rushed to buy up what they could. If you didn't get there quickly, you missed out. Queues became a common sight. Edgar Waite lived in Sunderland.
There was no rationing at the early part of the First World War. The result was that it was very difficult getting hold of food, especially meat, and women had to queue up in very early in the morning. Somebody would say, "Now there's a butcher shop up the road there, they've got some meat." And they'd queue open hours before the butcher shop opened, on the off chance of perhaps only getting a bone with a bit of meat on, that would just accept anything that was going. It was the same with cigarettes. Somebody along the street would see a chap, he'd say, that, "By the way, there's some cigarettes to be had down such and such a place," and there'd be a mad rush there, and you had to accept anything they offered them. If you're a man standing up inside the shop, say, "I've got a packet of Woodbines. Anybody want a packet of a mad rush?" Or you've perhaps got a packet of some fancy cigarettes. That through no rationing scheme in operation, it made things very difficult to purchase either cigarettes, beer or food. For a long stretch of the war, it was very difficult, especially buying meat, that sort of thing.
Queuing for food was a time-consuming business, so many housewives sent their children to monitor local shops. Dorothy Lester did so for her mother while a schoolchild living in London.
There was no rationing at first, and it was pretty awful to get food. And there were three boys next door to us, and Ernie was the same age as I was. He and I used to roam the streets looking at the shops, and I can remember seeing a queue in a shop, forgotten its name, and some of us would stay in the queue, not really knowing what there was, and send the other person home to tell our mothers to come with some money. And our mothers would come, and there would be margarine or something that they'd get on the shop. As a child, of course, we were given everything that was available. My mother, no doubt, went without herself to feed my father and the two of us.
For those who were working long hours, queuing for food was especially difficult. Leeds munition worker Elsie McIntyre found it very tiring.
The most awful thing was food. It was very scarce. And as we are coming off shift, someone would say, "There is a bit of steak at the butcher's." And I would get off the train and then go on the tram, and I'd get off on Belly Road and run to the shop, only to find a long queue. And by it got to my turn, there would be no more meat, only half a pound of sausage, you see. And that's coming off the night shifts. You went straight into a queue before you could go to bed. And by then, my mother would be in home kneading half a stone of flour for the kids, you see. We were lucky if we got up to bed by 11 a.m. and up again at 4 to catch the train, 5 o'clock to Bambo.
Some found a way round the shortages. Jane Cox lived in London with her family.
I can remember lining up for potatoes. Meat, that didn't worry us because we never had plenty of meat. Fruit, we'd have fruit once a week, so it didn't. Those shortages didn't worry us. Marge was fourpence a pound, and when my boyfriend came home with his, he had the naval uniform, you know, he was like a petty officer, and he'd go to the shops and he'd get a little bit more, see, and my mother always relied on him coming home.
After years of shortages, queues and hunger, British workers had had enough. A series of protests and strikes took place, demanding the government take action. George Hodgkinson took part in one held in Coventry.
In fact, in 1917, in Coventry here, we had an enormous demonstration against shortages, and we carried banners, equal food, equal distribution, or question mark. And this was a veiled threat that if there were not proper distribution of food, unless there was a proper regard at top level, or the need for reasonable allocations and so on. And the mass parades with the homemade banners and slogans and a complete sense of solidarity.
Full rationing was finally introduced in Britain in 1918. Key foodstuffs like sugar, meat, butter, cheese and margarine were now apportioned more fairly. William Holmes explained how the system worked.
You could only have so much. You had a ration card. Everyone had a ration card that was numbered. And in order to buy anything, you had to take it to the butcher or the baker or anybody. And he would mark on that ration book what he was giving you, you see. You only had a certain amount. You were allowed so many ounces of this or so much, you know, meat and all that kind of wheat. We had enough, but it wasn't. You couldn't have what you wanted, like normally. Oh, no, we never starved or anything like that. No.
Despite the introduction of rationing, some people still went hungry. Dorothy Bing explained the difficulties she and her family had as vegetarians.
The people who, as soon as there was rationing, bought up vegetarian foods, you see. And so there was nothing, the extra things that weren't rationed just disappeared. And we had a very thin time, actually, as far as food was concerned. It was very difficult indeed. My father was a strict vegetarian. And we had, I think everybody had so many eggs. We had more cheese than the other people, that's right. That was about the only thing, I think, we had a little more cheese. But my mother was a very wonderful manager, so we didn't starve. But father said he used to dream of food when he got so bad at times. When he was at times, he used to dream that he, you know, there was a lovely spread in front of him, and he'd never dreamed of food before in his life. But it had that effect, you felt. We used to pass by the shops where there was nothing at all, quite empty, you see. And if you could get a bar of chocolate, you thought you were in heaven. It was very difficult.
Civilians were seen as fair game during the First World War. As well as being threatened with starvation, they were attacked from the air. German airships had raided Britain since 1915, and 2 years later, Gotha bombers also began terrorising the population. Londoner Florence Parsons recalled her horror at the sight of them.
I was up in the city, and it was a Saturday morning. I went to the street door, and all of a sudden I said, "Oh, look at all that lot coming over, like a lot of birds." And it was the new thing they got out, aeroplanes, they called the Gothas in those days. All coming along. Oh, and everybody panicked, seeing the terrace houses all the way along. We see them coming over, so we run across that way and see them going over. They'd already dropped the bombs in the city, so I wasn't up there that Saturday morning. Already dropped the bombs up in the city, the Gothas. Then they came at night. The city, as you know, was all bombed. And I didn't go to work anymore up there, not then. It frightens you because not one comes over, but a great flock of Gothas.
There was no real system in place for civilians to shelter from the raids. Edwin Hiles lived in Hoxton in London. He was only 3 years old when war broke out.
I was in the infants class there, of course. And it was in the infants class that I could well remember the teacher saying, "Come, come, children. We're going to play a new game." And we were taken into a nearby cloakroom and there told to hide our faces in the coats. Any coat. Choose any coat you wish, but hide your face. Keep away from the windows. Later on, I discovered there'd been a serious air raid on London by German Gotha aircraft and quite a lot of children had been killed in the East End of London.
Over 1,400 people in Britain were killed in air raids during the First World War, and more than 3,400 were wounded. Ada Kyle had an early memory of the damage caused to Folkestone by Gothas in May 1917.
Well, my mother put us to bed, and there was a lot of banging, and when I called out to my mother, "Mum, what's all that noise?" She said, "Oh, don't be silly, it's only the boys." She said, "They've got some ladders at the back." So, of course, I believed her. So she go on, get off to sleep, got to go to school in the morning. Well, this noise kept going on, and I kept calling out, "Mum, Mum, no." No answer from Mum. So, of course, marches myself downstairs, there's no Mum. And I thought, "Oh, I know where she is, she's along Grand's." And I toddles off, and my grandma wasn't in. So as I came out, I started to grizzle, and a lady said to me, "What's the matter?" I said, "I can't find my mum and I can't find my gran." "Oh," she said, "they're along in the alley, dear, but don't go along there." Well, that was the worst thing she could have said, because I goes along there. As I gets to the alley, there's my mother. She had a white apron, taking it off and ripping it up and binding a man that had his leg blown off, and I can see that now.
Allied aircraft also bombed German cities, which caused much the same panic amongst the population as in Britain. Herber Haas lived in Frankfurt.
The air raids came with the war, as was inevitable, and everybody was frightened. We had to go to the cellar, and we had no electric light in our flat. All clothes had to be put on a chair so that one could dress in no time, as quickly as possible, and rush down to the cellar where the whole house met then. Air raids occurred on cloudless nights mainly, and we heard the planes coming, we heard the anti-aircraft guns, and everybody got more and more frightened. And the air raids caused one death, which I very well remember, at a junction of several streets. In plain daylight, a man was hit by a bomb or bomb splinter, something of the kind, and the whole town talks about it, and the whole town's very upset about it.
The pressures of wartime led to increasing state control over civilians' lives. In Britain, the Defence of the Realm Act restricted many aspects of life on the home front. One regulation was a reduction in pub opening hours, in an attempt to reduce drunkenness, such as that witnessed by J. Greatorex in Derby.
In those days, the beer was very, very strong, and I think most of the men there, and unfortunately father included, used to do quite a bit of drinking. And as I say, the beer was very, very strong in those days. And if you was out at night, you wouldn't have to wander through many streets before you found somebody drunk and rolling all over the pavement. Because in those days, there was two or three pubs in practically every main street. A lot more public houses than what there is now. It was about a penny a pint, as I remember.
Entertainment and socialising offered some reprieve from wartime life. But as London schoolboy Dennis Barker discovered, the conflict was never far away.
We got pictures for a penny. And Charlie Chaplin kept our morale up, because he came out in 14. He made a picture called Tilly's Punctured Romance with Mari Dresler. It was a six-part comedy. That was in 1914. And down the Old Kent Road near the Willowbrick Bowers Arms, there used to be a railway there, where all the stalls used to be. There used to be a little cinema. There was a South London place here, the old Variety Theatre. There was the Elephant, where they used to do straight plays. The Homan Empire, New Cross Empire, Lewisham Empire, Woolwich Empire, and they all did a roaring business. They still carried on with the act shortly. You could about 12 acts for a penny. Tuppence Up with the Gods, and about sixpence downstairs for best seat. They kept it on all the time. Zeppelin Rays, or no Zeppelin Rays, well, they didn't worry about them much.
Wartime governments knew it was important for civilians to support the war. Propaganda stoked up patriotic fervour and hatred of the enemy. But many, like schoolboy Leslie Friswell, didn't place much trust in what they heard.
There was a whole lot of these atrocity stories floating about, but I don't think that they made much effect. I mean, it was a propaganda move, of course, but as far as I recall, it was pretty fruitless, as that, you know, it was all taken very much with a grain of salt, that unlike World War II, when they really had the concentration camps. But no, the stories that were told, I think, were, you know, one has to discount those as propaganda.
Munitions worker Thomas Pack was motivated to join the army by the propaganda he heard.
I think that's what made you more eager to go, you know, when you hear where they used to take the baby from the woman and kill the baby and then rape the woman and kill her and all that, you know. You've got all those stories, which most of it propaganda, I think, you know. Well, of course, some of our chaps are just as bad out there, you know. I mean, we weren't all saints. I mean, do things which you shouldn't do, but I think the Germans were a bit callous, you know. More or less you accepted it, you know, and I suppose you took notice of it, really, to a degree, you know.
Atrocity stories resulted in widespread anti-German feeling in Britain. Henry Dotchin from Middlesbrough admitted his hatred of Britain's enemy.
I hated them. There you are. And I'm not going to say that I didn't. And as now, I don't like them. When you come to realise all the things that they did to people, human beings, everybody heard about what they were doing, the Germans, to people. I mean, if they found a man that was injured, They didn't used to try and get him put right. They used to shoot him. Put him out of his misery, they used to say. I never took any prisoners, the Germans. I know.
Spy fever was common across Europe, and there was intermittent violence against anyone seen as being one of the enemy. Percy Atwood recalled an example of this where he lived in Hackney.
And I well remember the anti-German riots, well, they weren't called riots, they were demonstrations in them days. We had a baker in Chapters Road called Heinrich Lunkenheimer, and he called himself Henry Lunken. Well, obviously he left Germany, to escape the terror, see? And I often think what a wicked thing it was to do. People whisper about it, and through windows and stones at his house, his windows. Poor old Henry Lunken. Lord knows what happened to him after that.
Civilians were keen to follow the events of the war. Penny Larkin found she could rely on her mother to keep her up to date.
My mother, who was had a great sense of very drama, I suppose, used to regale us with the news as time went on. I remember that the terrible defeat of the British fleet at Jutland. Then, of course, it was discovered it hadn't been so bad as at first thought, and it was neither a victory nor a defeat. I remember her coming in. I remember I was burying a dead bird when she suddenly said that Kitchener was dead, having been torpedoed off Shetland, I think.
London factory worker Helen Poulter's sister saw some war news that had a more personal impact.
My sister, she had a boyfriend. He was in the Navy, and he was on the HMS Goliath. And we're leaving Garstin's, going home, walking down Collindale Avenue, and on the placards there was a little paper shop, confectioners and that. There it was, HMS Goliath sunk. All lost, you know. Yes, I think everybody lost somebody, everybody.
Macclesfield journalist Philip Murray visited the homes of the bereaved to collect information for his newspaper. He well remembered the effects of the high casualty numbers at the fighting fronts.
Those who had sons or husbands in the army, they were terribly worried. I remember sometimes when I was calling at homes and I was a boy, a woman would gasp, frightened, thinking I might have been a telegraph boy with some bad news. So they were very, very worried and sad and upset. We ran every week a roll of honour pictures of soldiers being killed or wounded and a little biographical sketch, you know, where the school they attended, their place of employment, their sporting and social activities. I was reporting these chiefly as a 14 or 15-year-old. I felt sad. I remember going one home, a bereaved home, and I saw a young mother bathing two little kiddies. That touched me.
George Park lived in Hull. He was one of the many British people who suffered the loss of a loved one.
My brother went. He was only 17. And they give a false age to get in. And we lost him when we lost a lot of Hull lads. He was in Colonel Shaw's mob. And May the 3rd, 1917... That's when they lost most of the Hull men. And they used to have a memorial service in Holy Trinity every May the 3rd. And Mother took me to the last one, you know, that slowly got worse and worse. And we went to the last one, held in a little chapel at Holy Trinity Church. He was posted missing, then wounded and missing, and we never found out exactly how he did die, or where he died, or what happened to him, like lots of others.
Wartime deprivations and restrictions did eventually come to an end for those on the home front, but the loss of life had an effect that never went away, as Kathleen Nesbitt explained.
It was a horrible feeling. I remember before I went to America, it seemed to me that every young man I knew was, I mean, the casualty lists were appalling. Every day one looked in the paper and there was someone one knew. A feeling not so much sort of a daily depression, but a kind of a feeling of what on earth is the future going to be like? Everybody's going to be dead. One felt all one's contemporaries seemed to be the first year of the war. The casualty list was so fantastic. It seemed all so useless and pointless.
Find out more about the First World War at rwm.org.uk. We'd really like to know what you think of these podcasts. Please rate us or leave a comment on iTunes. Listen out for podcast 36, The Wider War.